The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsensewealth.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Sheridan. Welcome to today's Financial Sense News Hour. We've got an exciting show coming up. Our first guest is Dave Nikoski at Vermilion Research. He sees an important shift happening in the market right now with mega cap tech stocks, energy, and the dollar. Then, for our Smart Macro segment this week, we cover some surprising data that we track here at our own firm, looking at the number of people facing job losses for every single state in the U.S. Currently, as we discussed today, nearly 70% of states are showing a rise in unemployment. That's the highest since 2009 and the 2020 COVID crash. So listen in as we delve into this data more in relation to next week's widely watched jobs report coming out. But first, here's Ryan Poplava for this week's wrap-up.
Economic results this week reinforce the idea that the Fed can begin to ease its restrictive policy by lowering rates and possibly adjust its quantitative tightening program, which is allowing its balance sheet to currently shrink. At its peak during the COVID pandemic, the Fed's balance sheet was nearing $9 trillion, but by the end of this February, it has dropped down to around $7.5 trillion. Oil touched $80 a barrel, and gold rose on the economic news this week as rates fell Friday. Semiconductor stocks continued their outperformance, while retailer earnings were viewed positively. Turning to the economic details, we got the Fed's preferred measure of inflation on Thursday in the PCE Price Index. Results were in line with expectations, with the year-over-year headline figure falling to 2.4% from 2.6% previously, and the core price index falling to 2.8% from 2.9. Coupled with the manufacturing ISM index dropping to 47.8 from 49.1 for February, as well as the University of Michigan consumer sentiment dropping to 76.9, and we had the catalyst for rates to fall and stocks to rise. Expectations for a rate cut in June went up on the economic news, with a 55% probability of a rate cut of a quarter point in June, according to the CME FedWatch tool. A month ago, the probability was only 5%, so investors are becoming comfortable with a rate cut coming later this year versus earlier. The current forecasts are for 4 rate cuts this year, down from 6 in January. Other important economic data received this week was the home data showing that January new home sales were up 1.8% from a year ago. The S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index was up 6.1%. And then finally, durable goods orders were down 6.1% in January. In tech news this week, Bloomberg published an article detailing the canceled efforts for Apple to build an electric car, but instead focus on generative artificial intelligence on Tuesday. Wednesday, many chip stocks fell as Applied Materials disclosed it had received multiple subpoenas from the government wanting to see information about its shipments to China. These stocks, however, surged higher on economic news Friday, as well as on good tech earnings results from NetApp and on Dell's positive earnings response after the company said it's seeing strong AI-optimized server momentum. Broadcom, Taiwan Semiconductor, and Advanced Micro Devices all rose mid-single-digit percentage points. Apple was not among the tech stars Friday, with the stock down on news Goldman Sachs removed it from its U.S. conviction list. Lots of politics in the week ahead. It's Super Tuesday on March 5th for the presidential primary, with 15 states holding contests next Tuesday. A late start to this year's State of the Union on Thursday, with Biden expected to comment on accomplishments of his first term and a glimpse of what's ahead if he wins a second term. Some of what I've read indicates if he is elected, there will be higher taxes on wealthy and corporations with an expansion of the safety net and benefits. Government funding has shifted from early March to March 8th and 22nd, with Congress expected to reach a deal by next week for the first part, but the second date covers 75% of government spending and could see more debate and added components, such as a recent discussion on a current tax bill or more funding for Ukraine and Israel. The other three events next week will be Powell's congressional testimony Wednesday, the non-farm payroll data on Friday, and more earnings announcements from Broadcom, Costco, DocuSign, and some retailers like Foot Locker, Abercrombie, and Gap. For my newsletter subscribers, two articles this week were posted. The first is seven common beneficiary mistakes investors make as I look at the financial planning mistakes I've seen and have read many articles about. The first is only assigning one beneficiary to your retirement, qualified plans, or insurance policies. The second is not updating documents based on changes in family dynamic or changes to the law. The third is combining designated with non-designated beneficiaries, which is a problem if carriers or administrators' policies don't allow for separate accounting. The fourth is not maximizing tax efficiency. This is next level estate planning when you consider what your children's tax rates are or those of a 501c charity. The fifth is using a trust as primary when a spouse may be the better option in some cases. Spouses have many options compared to a trust, such as rolling over qualified retirement account into their IRAs. Sixth, thinking your trust takes care of everything. I've seen and heard comments of, well, my IRA's in the trust. Maybe the trust talks about the IRA, but if the IRA has specific beneficiaries listed, that's what we'll carry. And finally, seventh is the realization that most heirs spend their inheritance in the first year and not accounting for the impact on their finances. The second article was my monthly big picture, which looked at momentum, options activity, growth versus value trends, a look at defensive sectors, and a decline in participation within the S&P 500 to higher prices that indicates it may be time for stocks to take a break. I also recommended good rebalancing habits when I see these conditions such as this. I'll be posting these articles next week on financialsense.com, but if you want early access to my articles, feel free, send me an email request to ryan.paplava@financialsense.com, and I'll be happy to add you. Up next, we've got David Nikoski, this week's guest technician.
It's being called a world model. Even OpenAI refers to it as that, which is really the peak of artificial intelligence. We want to get to a model that has an understanding of what's going on around us. And this one does. Sora is groundbreaking. And just in the last few weeks, Microsoft has chosen to invest in Mistral, now valued at $2.1 billion. They, like Google, came to this a little bit late. And I think they're making up for lost time. That means a lot of investments, a lot of partnerships, and a lot of pivoting their entire model. We can certainly see that with Google. There was a recent analysis by Gartner that said search engine volume will drop 25% in the next few years. So I can finally see an explanation for why Larry and Sergey rushed back into the Google offices to start helping with programming and testing. But China has a huge number of large language models coming out at a rate that is far faster than what we see over here in, let's call it, the Western world, but the US in particular.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
In 2 years, the expiration of the Trump tax cuts may result in higher taxes for many Americans. If you're tired of paying more taxes each year and want to keep more of your hard-earned money, consider reaching out to Financial Sense Wealth Management. Our team can assist you in creating a personalized financial plan aimed at lowering your taxes both now and in the future. With a custom-tailored approach, we can explore various options such as tax-free, tax-deferred, and tax-sheltered strategies to help alleviate your tax burden. By reducing your taxes, you'll have extra money in your pocket that can be used for spending, saving, or investing. Take the first step toward tax reduction by calling Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Our experienced advisors are ready to discuss your financial goals and design a plan that works for you. Remember, planning now can save you from paying more later. Financial Sense does not provide tax advice. Clients or prospects should consult with their own tax advisors to determine the potential tax benefits or consequences of engaging in a particular strategy or transaction.
Well, on Thursday, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge came in a bit on the hot side. What does this mean for the market and future rate cuts? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. Dave, your take on the inflation numbers and what that might mean. I know Wall Street was hoping for a March cut. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. Now they're hoping that by June, the Fed will start cutting, but some are saying not so fast.
Yeah, you know, we've been in the group for ever since, actually going back to 22, that, you know, when you break long-term downtrends, which hasn't happened in 40 years, you know, you don't resolve those in a short period. And, you know, our view is that it was going to be higher for longer. I think, you know, when you had the July meeting last year and the signal was that they weren't going to raise, he got the effects of saying, basically, I'm staying higher for longer. We're still in that camp that, you know, the economy is doing quite well, at least the equity markets are, and are not really responding, you know, to the higher rates that, you know, many would have expected. And again, you know, we're taking it in stride and investors are adjusting to, you know, what is likely going to be higher for longer. I'm not in the view that we're going to get a rate cut unless something breaks. I think that's the only thing that would, you know, stop the Fed from, you know, even likely raising, you know, this market has been on fire. And I think it goes against what the Fed really wants. He doesn't want asset prices to go higher. And, you know, that's the impact, you know, last year or so, many were trying to front run the Fed and they never got what they wanted, but the market did what, you know, their actions that were. So I think that we are going to have higher inflation. I think it's going to be rolling inflation. I compare it much to, you know, the 70s, not exactly, but, you know, that was a period in which you built out Japan. They went through a real estate bubble in 89. Now we're in the process of, you know, shortly after that, you know, the build out of China starting in 1998 to 2018 was a big build out in China. They're going through a real estate crisis. And now we are, you know, switching to onshoring and, you know, revitalizing our relationships with a number of other countries like India. And I think the potential for India to be similar to the next China is a likely high probability, which would suggest that, you know, that build out is going to take a massive amount of commodities. But, you know, it's hitting the cycle right. You know, energy is starting to improve. That's something that we're watching right now.
Well, you know, if you look at 2022, Dave, when the Fed started raising interest rates from nothing all the way up to 5%, we had a big sell-off in the market in 2022. But since then, as the Fed has sort of been on hold, the market seems to have become comfortable with interest rates where they are. I want to talk about last fall, we got down to, I think it was 3.8 on the 10-year note. If we take a look at where interest rates are now, we've got the 10-year note at almost 4.25. 2-year note is over 4.6. Interest rates have been rising. What's your take on interest rates here, especially since you believe the dollar could be rolling over? Explain.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the aspect of bonds being safety has been anything but, right? It's contrary to what we've seen, you know, in the last 40 years. And that goes along with that, you know, similar aspect that, you know, if you're a strategist and you're looking at data for how, you know, higher interest rates impact the market, you know, during that 40-year period, asset prices, you know, homes, that type of the value of, you know, durable type products only went up. I think that what we're seeing here is a real divergence, and the market is not responding to the higher rates because they realize that they're going to be higher for longer. You know, with the dollar aspect, you know, it's crushing, you know, emerging markets dramatically. You know, the relative performance is absolutely abysmal. And, you know, a similar period occurred back in, you know, after post the tech bubble, the U.S. dollar, you know, remained resilient until April of 2002. That was a period in which most foreigners were putting money into the U.S. equity markets because we are the best house in the neighborhood. And I think there's a similar characteristic to this market as well when you look around the world and see that we are far outperforming everything. I think we're kind of a magnet for, you know, dollars to flow to, even from foreign countries. So, my view is that the dollar is, looks like it's trying to run back into the resistance levels again. I like to see, in a bull market that there's a lot of other places participating. It's kind of like looking at the breadth of our market. I like to see a coordinated effort that, emerging countries are growing. Whereas in this case, they may have made the bottom, but they're not participating anywhere near the alpha that, I would like to see from a global aspect. I think a weaker dollar also, the problem with the weaker dollar is it will drive more inflation, right? We are a major importer of goods around the world. So I think it's in the Fed's best interest to make sure before they cut rates that we don't get another round of, an inflationary bout similar to the 70s. So I think they're going to keep the dollar stronger for longer.
So with our interest rates much higher in the U.S. than what we're seeing overseas, what's behind, in your opinion, this decline? You're right now in the day we're speaking, the dollar's a little over 104. You see it falling down to maybe in the 99 range. What's going to cause that, in your opinion?
I think the one thing that would cause that is if we did start to see, the aspects of an economic slowdown, job, unemployment start to rise. I wonder, in my opinion, going with that view, if, we haven't really adjusted unemployment. If you look in the state of California, what unemployment pays, or many of the other states, it's like looking back at the minimum wage, right? You haven't adjusted it for the period, and the payout in the unemployment in some states is $350 a week. You can get a basic wage job and make more than that. And that's what I think, my view is, that you're not going to see a huge spike in the unemployment, but you're going to get people that do lose their job are going to have to take a lower paying job. And it just simply to make ends meet, because they're going to collect a lot more. So I think the aspect of, the dollar, being able to decline, is, again, if we go into a recession, U.S. dollar is always a safe haven, but it typically goes into, a blow-off stage. And it's the release of that blow-off stage that can bring it down. And that would be something, akin to April 12th of 2002, we made one call that there would be a repatriation of funds by foreign investors in the U.S. market. And if you look at the S&P, in that April period, that went on to make a triple bottom. We saw a decline in the S&P close to 25%. Again, I'm not in that camp right now, because if you call it 20 times and you're right on the 20th time, by that time no one's listening to you because you made 19 wrong calls. But that would be my biggest fear when I see a number of articles, whether it be Wall Street Journal has highlighted, Chinese investors are flooding into our markets. Korea is, and there's a bastion of other countries where people are fearful in their own country and put, money into our equity markets. And it would be the rotation or repatriation of funds back home if they need it. And that's the only thing that I could see that could, push the dollar down.
I want to talk about what is many considering an alternative currency, which is cryptocurrencies, and especially Bitcoin. I'm looking at a chart here where it's gone from roughly around 24,000, hit a high on the day you and I are speaking at 63,852, that is. And now, Dave, we have not only the halving of Bitcoin, which occurs, I think, in about 45 days, but you also have ETFs. So as the public sees Bitcoin going up, they're moving that money into these ETFs, which means these ETFs are going to have to go out and buy more Bitcoin. What's your take on cryptos here?
Well, I think it's a signal, and it's something that we don't have a long-term correlation to equity markets in the U.S. dollar, utilizing Bitcoin. In terms of looking at other periods like the 70s when Bitcoin and the whole philosophy of cryptocurrency didn't exist. It certainly is an avenue that investors are gravitating to. It's impossible to determine whether that's pure speculation or concerns about, what could happen to the U.S. dollar. It also shows the liquidity of the market more than anything. So, I think it's, the charts on the cryptos look great. It's the turning points that you have to worry about. I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert at cryptocurrency, but I can, certainly see the chart. And yes, investors are flooding into it hand over fist.
And Dave, in your opinion, how much has crypto taken away from the gold market? Typically, if you had inflation, you had wars, turmoil, gold was safe haven. Although I have to admit, gold has been holding above 2,000 here for 14, 15 weeks now.
Yeah. I think it's displacing gold by the younger investors out there. And, some of us old gray haired guys, we're sitting here going, this doesn't make sense, but the dollar has remained resilient, and it's until the dollar comes down, do you probably get any, movement into, the precious metals? But it is what it is, and we have to learn from it and change over time. So, it's much like some of the useful tools that, some of us old Wall Street folks have used don't, fit into the pattern of what we're seeing now. You've seen the, ODT options, that they're extremely high traded. Margin debt is low. It's not like we're seeing a bubble top in terms of margin debt, but, that might be maybe the attraction of playing options for many people. And, that seems to be growing in terms of volume. So again, it's adjusting to what new things are out there that we didn't have to look back on from a historical standpoint.
I want to talk about performance. What we're starting to see, last year was kind of the Mag 7. It looks like the market is starting to broaden out somewhat. We're seeing some movement in the mid caps. And, taking a look at the S&P sectors, you've got consumer discretionary doing well, consumer staples doing well at the same time. Most of the time you'd see them in opposite directions. They're both going in the same. You've got financials doing well, industrials doing well, healthcare doing well. What's your take on, is this a broadening out of the market in your opinion?
Yeah, at the end of October, our group had highlighted the divergences we saw in percentage of stocks above the 50-day, looking at the S&P as well as the Russell 2000. At that time, we made a call that, we'd likely see a 20% rally, in the Russell 2000. And that was just, looking at the sector weightings in the Russell 2000. Banks and biotech were, two of the larger weightings in that particular index. But what most people don't realize is the Russell 2000 is only 5% of the weighting in the Russell 3000. So you have 1,000 stocks that contain 95% of the weighting. If you just had 1% go into the Russell 2000, there's your 20% gain. And I do see the market broadening out. The biggest concern I have is in the financials. When you look at the regional banks, they are not showing significant strength. They're not breaking down, but they're not participating. I still find a number of banks and a number of REITs that remain in downtrends. And I think that, the market is kind of shrugging that off and saying, why own banks if we don't know what's in the portfolio? Might as well own tech and industrials and look at the market that way as well as healthcare. So, the biggest concern I have as a technician is the sector weightings. There's never not been some form of bubble when a sector gets above 30%. You saw that, in energy in 1981. Now energy is 4%, so that's my concern is you can have pretty big moves out of these small areas. Like I mentioned, the Russell 2000, you could get just 1% of fund flows going into energy could push it up 25%. And, we're starting to see that within the energy front. you know, we're market weight, but, you know, we've been discussing with clients that we're seeing a lot of positive activity there. But, you know, it takes very little capital to move it now when it's such a small weighting.
Yeah, the other thing, too, that's been fueling this is just by the very nature of the way they structure indexes, market cap weighting in the S&P, price weighting in the Dow Jones Industrials. So as more and more money goes into index funds, it's going to go, what is it, 30% is going to be going in those Mag 7 stocks. So it could drive them up even further.
Yeah, you know, passive investing, you know, when everyone's doing it, it's going to work great, you know, especially if you're buying the index. You know, I think there's a lot of thought that, you know, passive investing is pushing the S&P up, for instance. You know, I'm going to take a you know, kind of a counter argument to that. And when I talk to, you know, our clients, you know, if you were doing that, then you would be getting, you know, equal equivalent performance out of everything in the S&P, and that would include utilities and staples. However, they're greatly underperforming. So, you know, most of this passive money is going into the tech side, from what I see, and more recently into healthcare and, you know, microcap biotechs. And just a quick comment on the biotechs, you know, that is a speculation indicator that we have used for, you know, for years. I've been in this business for 38 years. And when you see money come into stocks that, you know, don't have a product, you make money, you know, that gives you an indication of the speculation of investors as a group. And, you know, from what we're seeing there, it does indicate that, yes, we're in a bull market.
So if you had money to deploy in, obviously, you know, one benchmark you can look at, what are the chances I'm going to make more than what I can get in T-bills, which are about 5%? Where would you be putting money here?
Well, I'm leery of tech. When I look at something like the SOX index, I see this major rising wedge. I find enough names in there. You know, when people think of, you know, hear that and look at that index, you know, what they don't realize is names like Texas Instruments has underperformed the S&P over the last, you know, 14 months by 40%. Analog devices, same thing. Microchip, same thing. You know, what you're seeing, there's a big divergence between old economy and new economy stocks. And in terms of tech, you know, what I do like right now is energy. I think energy can have a fairly sizable move, especially when it's such a small area. I think biotech is just breaking out of the XBI, is breaking out of a major base. So I find more than enough that growth money can still move into the biotechs. And again, it takes very little money to move a very small index. And I think that's what you're seeing since October, that the, you know, outperformance of biotech versus XLK or the SOX index has been substantial.
What about things like industrials?
We're very bullish on industrials. We made a call back in October or August of 22 that this big move to onshoring would push engineering and construction stocks up. You know, you have names like EMCOR, Limbaugh, which is an HVAC company. A number of the HVAC companies are, you know, at all-time highs. Anything that's associated with the building of infrastructure is doing extremely well, and that's part of the IRA Act. So we like a lot in the industrials, you know, and probably less so in the defense area. Everyone talks about Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin, but, you know, the relative strength, you know, from what I see, is certainly not in that area, despite, you know, what we have going on around the globe.
So if there was anything that could throw your forecast off or something that could disrupt the market, whether that be, you know, higher inflation or something, who knows, another geopolitical outbreak, what would that be in your opinion?
Well, you know, I think inflation is going to be kind of a rolling situation. I think the aspect that, you know, if you have a breakout in the 10-year above the 450, 460 level, you know, we would probably, you know, look at, you know, how the market is responding to it, because thus far, the market is not really responsive to the higher rates. You know, the other thing would be the dollar breaking out, you know, above the 104.50, 104.60 level. You know, we would want to see how the market responds to that type of behavior. But, you know, again, it's not something I can predict or forecast. I have to wait to see if it happens and how the market responds.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at Vermilion, how could they do so?
Well, you can go to our website, vermilioncap.com is a good way to get us. And, you know, all the information, phone numbers and everything are on that. It's, again, vermilioncap.com, one L in Vermilion.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, it was a pleasure having you on the program. All the best, and hope to talk to you again soon.
The short answer is no, I do not think they're in a bubble, at least if we're talking about sort of the Magnificent Seven, right? The large kind of mega cap tech companies, NVIDIA being the poster child for that group. The gains are truly outrageous, what we've seen over the past year. But if you're looking at sort of typical valuation metrics, I think the conclusion is clear. No, they are not in a bubble. In the 90s, those companies were seeing huge rallies that were driven off multiple expansion. So essentially, think of it like this. People saw these companies and they thought, oh my God, the internet's going to take over everything. These companies are going to make a gazillion dollars in the coming years. So I'm willing to pay 100 times earnings or 200 times earnings or 300 times earnings, right? Well, of course, it turned out they didn't make nearly as much money as everybody thought they were going to. So those stocks eventually came crashing back to earth, as we, many of us, lived through, right? What's happening now with the Magnificent Seven and AI stocks, it, broadly speaking, is that it's not this idea of, oh my God, these companies are going to make so much money on AI in the future, I'm willing to pay 100 times earnings. What's actually happening is they are making much more money than they have previously. NVIDIA earnings have been growing by multiples over the past 2 years. And here's a crazy point. NVIDIA stock is up, I think, over 200% over the past year or 2 years or something like that. But the price to earnings ratio has declined sharply from over 60 to now in the mid 30s. And the reason is because the company is making so much money. So while these gains are amazing, they have largely been justified by the actual financial results, not the potential financial results.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, today we're going to look at a number of different charts that we're going to be discussing, which we'll have posted along with this interview on Financial Sense. Joining us on the show today is Chris Poplava, CIO of Financial Sense Wealth Management. So, Chris, let's jump into this first chart that you sent me. It shows the number of states with rising unemployment rates. And as you were telling me, this should be considered as a leading indicator. It looks a bit alarming. So tell me, what's the story with this chart?
So, you know, before I get into this, Chris, just kind of stating where our firm's positioned, we're dead neutral. And we've been this way for a while because we don't think the debate between hard or soft landing has actually been solved or resolved. Essentially, I think either outcome is a possibility.
So there is risk of a recession, which obviously would have a huge impact to risk assets, the economy in general. And in a soft landing, if we actually end up getting that, then we should have a little bit more of the same. So how you position really is determined by the outcome of whether we have a hard or soft landing. So I continue to intently really focus in. And what I think, Chris, is it elongated the cycle where essentially we went into a manufacturing recession because of COVID, right? We had an overabundance of manufacturing. We had basically empty shelves. So we had to ramp up manufacturing once we could go back to work. And that demand with all the stimulus checks really led to a lot of purchases of goods and things. And once we had that demand satisfied, essentially we had a glut of inventory. And so to get through that inventory, we basically had to kind of go backwards and shut manufacturing plants down. And so that led to the manufacturing recession, which really, I believe, began back in 2022, for the most part, and it's been in contraction since. However, the holdout is the bulk of the economy, which is services. And the consumer and jobs have been relatively strong. The consumer continues to spend. So we haven't had a full-blown recession because the service side of the economy has not faltered. However, I do think, Chris, the number one thing to zero in on is jobs. You lose your jobs, obviously you're going to cut back dramatically in terms of your spending. And if you don't have any income coming in, you're going to be foreclosed on, you're going to force to sell your home. So we might see housing inventories really pick up, which could hurt housing prices. So there's just a whole host of ramifications that happen depending on the outlook for the jobs market. And that's one thing, as I mentioned, I'm really looking at, because jobs have clearly been slowing on a rate of change basis. So do we reaccelerate? Then I think the nail would be in the coffin for the soft landing. However, if things continue to decelerate and turn negative, then I think that really does open up the door for the recession call. So when we look at the two surveys that the government does, we have the household survey where the government picks up the phone and calls people and asks, are you working? And then we have the non-farm payroll report or establishment survey, which is usually what Wall Street keys in on and discusses. They don't really talk about the household survey all that much. But they could not be more night and day over the last, let's say, 6 months or so. When we look at September on the household survey, only 50,000 jobs were created. That's not high enough to keep the unemployment rate stable. The October, we saw a loss of 270,000. November, we had a seasonal Christmas holiday period gain of 586. But that was more than offset in December after the holiday shopping season, when we had a 683,000 job loss. In December, losses continued with 31,000 jobs lost. So going back 5 months to September, three out of those five have seen job losses. And when we look at the establishment survey, there hasn't been one negative report. The weakest we saw was in October of 165,000. And we've had as high as 353,000, which was for January. So they're diametrically opposed to each other. And when you look at November, which was the peak for the household survey, we've seen a net decline of roughly 845,000 jobs since November. That's massive. I mean, that's nearly a million lost jobs since November. You look at the establishment survey, it's the polar opposite. We're seeing a growth of nearly 700,000 jobs. So they're really at odds with each other, and someone's going to be proven right here. Either we need to see the household survey pick up, or non-farm payrolls need to start rolling over. Which brings me to the first chart, Chris, that I sent you, is the percent of states with rising unemployment. And the way I measure that is whether their unemployment rate is above their two-year moving average. And I also measure it against their three-year moving average. And so what I'm looking at is what percent of U.S. states have their unemployment rate above their two-year moving average. And in once we get to recession, Chris, we get up to 100% every time. And leading into recession, often at times, the recession starts somewhere between 60 to 70% of states are having a rising unemployment rate, and then eventually that goes up to 100. So when I look at where we are currently, as of December, 69% of the U.S. states have a rising unemployment rate. And Chris, outside of a recession, that is the highest level that we've seen. And here's where I take a little bit odds, Chris, with the soft landing notion. If you go back to the mid-80s, mid-90s, where we did have a soft landing being a deceleration in growth without a material rise in unemployment, the percent that had rising unemployment rates, it didn't even cross the 50% threshold. It was about 40 to maybe 45%. And then it turned back down as the economy reaccelerated. We're at 69. So it's conceivable, Chris, that this is actually the start of a recession could have began in December, just looking at past examples of where the recession timeline is relative to seeing about 70% of states with a rising unemployment rate. And even when I look at a three-year moving average, we've got about 25% of states are witnessing an unemployment rate above their three-year moving average. Now, that's on par, Chris, with the mid-80s and 90s slowdown. But again, this is still early, and this has shown no signs of peaking. It's been going straight up. Every month, there's more and more states with rising unemployment. To me, the sharp rise tells me we've seen a pretty dramatic change in unemployment across the nation.
All right. Well, Chris, let me push back on that for a second, because the headlines today proclaiming this is a very troubling stat here, that the U.S. national debt is rising by $1 trillion about every 100 days. And we've been discussing this a lot on our show about how if you look at the official government website, I mean, this is straight from the government. They say even for this fiscal year, 2024, we've spent now over $2 trillion, 10% above what we spent last year for fiscal year 2023. And that was $6 trillion then. So we're on pace, at least at this point, to spend more than $6 trillion for fiscal year 2024. And a lot of people would say that that is one of the main reasons why we never saw a recession materialize in 2023, which nearly all of the historically reliable leading indicators were pointing to, is because the government is spending money like drunken sailors to prevent us from getting into a recession. So my question is to you is, if we're going to be spending $6 trillion this year or more, is it possible that this is going to, again, fail like some of these other indicators in predicting a recession?
Well, going straight to the deficit, Chris, we've got a supply problem. Because if we keep spending like drunken sailors, as you mentioned, we're going to be flooding the market with treasuries, pushing yields higher. Look what happened with New York Community Bank. I mean, it was down after hours. I'm not sure what it's down today, but it was down double digits. Commercial real estate is reeling. You have people unable to afford a home. So home sales are, you know, in the dumps. And if we continue to spend like this, then we're going to continue to see higher interest rates, which is going to pressure everyone. So, you know, a lot of that spending is on interest. Now, I will say with that spending that we had last year fiscally, we were still adding jobs. Even when you look at the household survey, the first 9 months of the year, we had a pretty robust jobs growth, even if you look at the establishment survey. So both surveys were showing pretty consistent jobs growth. As big as the government is, Chris, there was no one, I mean, the elephant in the room, the 800-pound, you know, gorilla or, you know, elephant in the room, that's, we're talking about the U.S. consumer. There was no one more important to the U.S. economy than the consumer.
Yeah, 68% in fourth quarter 2023 was U.S. consumer spending accounting for economic activity. So, yeah, like you're saying, if the consumer decides to pull back on spending, there goes the economy.
Exactly. And as you know, as I mentioned earlier, manufacturing has been in a downturn for well over a year, but it's not that big of a part of the economy. And it was not enough to push us or pull us into a recession. However, it's the same story. As big as the government is, on the flip side, where manufacturing was contracting the economy, the government is adding to growth. If the consumer falters, I don't care what the government is doing. I mean, given the size of the U.S. consumer, things are going to roll over. And that's why also, Chris, why I still kind of have the hairs up on the back of my neck. And, you know, as I've been saying for some time now, I'm keeping a close eye on the exits, is I'm seeing the household survey, which is not its actual bean counting, so to speak. It's picking up the phone. There's no estimations. There's no models. There's no birth death. It is actually calling in, you know, depending on the sample you get, you know, obviously it can fluctuate, but still there's no growth in jobs. We're losing jobs. And I'm seeing it, as I mentioned, Chris, in our last segment, looking at foot store traffic for discount retailers like Ross, TJ Maxx, Burlington, versus Nordstrom's, Dillard's, Kohl's, Macy's. And the foot store traffic is completely the polar opposite, where it's growing in discounters, and in the high-end retailers, it's falling off a cliff. So we're seeing the consumer voting with their wallet in terms of giving you a reality check of where they're at. And and even looking at the savings rate, Chris, I mean, all the hallmark signs of a consumer that's tapped, right? The savings rate goes down, and then you start to see credit card usage surge because they're turning to their last door to open to basically keep things going and continue their standard of living. But when you start seeing consistent and persistent job losses, well, you know, game over. So I'm bringing all of this up because next Friday we get the jobs report for February. And we should also get the state data for January, which I'm really interested in seeing. So everything I've mentioned today, I'm going to be looking to see how that changes. And, you know, other things that I've mentioned in the past, Chris, is full-time employment. Full-time employment has rolled over just as it does before every recession, sizably so. And part-time employment is picking up because these are all the things that a business does when things are getting tight. They reduce hours, they get rid of temporary staff, and they cut hours. And eventually, when there's no more strings to pull, they finally have to let their workers go. So these are things that I'm seeing that do present some significant challenges. Full-time employment, Chris, peaked in the last recession about a month or two before the recession began, and more or less right on cue with the 2001 recession. So full-time employment, Chris, that peaked in the middle of last year, and it's down sizably. And the amount of decline that we're down right now is roughly where we were about halfway through the 2008 recession. And obviously, job losses accelerated, but it kind of gives you an idea of, you know, I would be very cautious of declaring the all clear right now.
So, Chris, as you're pointing out, this chart is showing a parabolic rise in the number of people that are moving into unemployment across the U.S. So it definitely bears watching when it comes to, like you said, the soft landing, hard landing debate here. And, you know, one thing it just leads me to wonder is if we do see a softness in the job market, how quickly are we going to see the modern monetary theory implementation that we saw post-COVID of issuing stimulus checks out to consumers? You know, once you start a government program like that and it becomes normalized, well, you know, it's pretty easy to do that again. So it'll be interesting to see how quickly that type of response comes. Now, you do have another chart that you sent me looking at Treasury cash balance, and this has to do with market liquidity. So the amount of liquidity that the government is basically issuing and how this relates to the market. You show that next to the S&P 500. Tell us, what is this chart telling you? Is this bullish or bearish?
Well, it just gives it's kind of like potential versus kinetic energy. To me, you know, there's a lot of potential energy for liquidity to get injected into the economy and markets. It's just a question of which way does it go. And what I'm talking about is the Treasury's cash account at the Fed. So after we shut down the government, we had the debt crisis back in, I believe, 2011. The Treasury was allowed to issue more debt than it needed to run the government, to basically have a rainy day fund to tap into if we ever have a debt ceiling issue. And what we saw coming out of COVID going into 2021 is that cash account at the Fed got up to $1.8 trillion. Incredibly high number. And Janet Yellen began to draw that down in 21 from, you know, roughly, let's say, 1.8 trillion to basically zero by the end of 21. And that was a huge, massive injection of liquidity that helped propel the market higher. And within 1 month of the Treasury account going to zero, the stock market peaked and began to decline in the bear market of 2022. Part of the problem, too, was that once it went to zero, Janet Yellen began to issue above levels of Treasury issuance, and that helped to push rates higher, which helped push stocks lower. But eventually, it got up to, I believe, around $800 billion by the middle of 22, And that helped to kind of kick off the first part of the decline in the stock market. And once that peaked at, you know, roughly around 900 billion in the summer of '22, the market started to stabilize. And then in the back half of '22 and in the first half of '23, Janet Yellen ran that down from a trillion all the way back down to zero. And that was a huge source, I think, to help stabilize the stock market, which bottomed in October of '22 and head higher last year. However, once we basically got through the debt ceiling debate in Congress last year in the middle of this summer, Janet Yellen started to issue debt again, which was withdrawing liquidity and cash out of the market and giving that to the Treasury. And that could have hurt the stock market, but it didn't. And as of today, Chris, it stands at about $767 billion. But part of the reason, Chris, why it didn't really hurt the market is just as the middle of 23, it was starting to rise from zero, we were seeing the repo facility at the Fed, which stood at about $2.5 trillion, begin to unwind. And that dramatically unwound from about $2.5 trillion in, you know, beginning of 23. It stood around $2.25 trillion in the summer. And that went from $2.25 trillion, Chris, to the end of the year, it was down to about $500 billion. So just under $2 trillion was injected from the repo facility into financial markets in the last 6 months of 23. That's not unlike the nearly $2 trillion that the Treasury's cash account, the Fed, injected back in 2021. So it's easy to see how those things really help propel the market higher, which really had nothing to do with economic fundamentals. This is just liquidity. But it can have such a huge impact because we're talking about hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars that we need to bear this in mind. So where we stand today, Chris, we stand today where the repo facility is at $441 billion. It is a fraction of where it was, and there's still a couple hundred billion left to go. But I think, Chris, we're getting to the point where it's going to get pretty close to zero, and that may force the Fed to stop quantitative tightening so that it doesn't withdraw too much reserves from the system. We have a repo crisis again. And that could be what gold is starting to sniff out, is we're getting closer to that point where, regardless of rate cuts, the Fed's quantitative tightening program may be coming to an end. But it does still say that there's several hundred billion that could help propel the stock market higher. And as I mentioned to you, the Treasury has $767 billion in cash that they can inject. And I have a feeling, Chris, that they built that up to have that available leading into the November elections. We're looking at March right now, the day you and I are speaking, March 1st. And my gut tells me that the Treasury, from pressure from the White House, will be injecting that money to help keep the stock market afloat, help keep the economy afloat as we go into the November elections. So, you know, the bears out there do need to bear that in mind. You know, $700 billion here, $400 billion there. I mean, we're talking over $1 trillion of potential stimulus that could get injected into the market. So the Treasury doesn't have any control of the repo facility, but it does have control, obviously, of their cash account at the Fed. But we do have to be aware that both those massive sectors of liquidity are present.
Yeah, as you were talking, it really reminded me of that famous quote, a billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about a lot of money. You know, in this case, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars. Yeah. And, you know, when you're talking about some of these cross currents, when we look at the rising unemployment rate across the states throughout the United States, how this is a leading indicator, that's obviously bearish. But then we also have on the political side, at least when we come to fiscal and monetary policy, looking at Treasury liquidity and how that impacts the market, that could be a bullish tailwind. You know, one thing that we often refer to here is this three-legged stool of analyzing markets, where you have the fundamentals, you have the technicals, and then you have the politicals. And the politicals, of course, being fiscal and monetary policy and the role that those play. So a number of cross currents here, but what would you say from the technical picture currently?
You know, I think we're extremely extended. And I honestly, I think, Chris, the catalyst for a correction is probably going to be the jobs report. It needs to come in just right, Goldilocks, for the market not to sell off. If it comes in too hot, then you're going to get concerns of no Fed rate cuts, which the market's not going to want. If it comes in way below estimates, then you're going to get recessionary talks. So you want it to come in just soft enough to give the Fed room to cut rates, but not too hot, not too cold. So that's a tight needle to thread through that I really think you're going to see a lot of hedging going on going into that report and afterwards.
So a number of things that could shock the market or the consensus view, which is why, as you said today, you're still sticking to that neutral view on the market, not overly exposed to cash, not overly exposed to stocks, but keeping a balanced portfolio at present.
Absolutely, Chris. Yeah, I think you have to really keep your options open and your mind open, because even if the backdrop is bearish, I mean, with all this influx into AI and liquidity, you might see the stock market diverge from the real economy. That is very possible. So we'll just have to see, Chris, but it's definitely something to keep in mind.
Well, again, as we close, I want to recommend that all of you check out the charts and data that we discussed in today's show, especially the big pickup that we're seeing in unemployment across all the various states here in the U.S. It's an important chart to look at, as well as the Treasury liquidity and some of the other things that we outlined in today's show. If you have any questions or feedback on what we discussed, or if there's any items that you'd like to go into in our future Smart Macro segments with Chris Poplava, feel free to reach out to us by going to financialsense.com and hitting the Contact Us button. And Chris, always a pleasure to get an update from you. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
And it should be interesting, Chris. We'll have the jobs report and a few other really big reports to digest. So we'll be chock full of information.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939. Or you can also visit us on our website, financialsensewealth.com. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.